Okay, so this is lecture two in chapter 19. We call it eukaryotic DNA, 97% junk. And we're going to talk about coding versus non-coding DNA. And we'll start with prokaryotes. And the interesting thing about prokaryotes is that almost all the DNA in prokaryotes codes for proteins. And that's because prokaryotes have a very small, you know, they've got that circular DNA, and they don't have a lot of it, so everything has to count. They can't have any waste. Eukaryotes like you and me, well, most of our DNA doesn't code for anything. In fact, 97% of human DNA doesn't even code for proteins, and that's why we call it quote-unquote junk DNA. So that means about only 3% or less of your DNA codes for proteins, which is pretty remarkable. And that, of course, causes us to ask the question, well, what about all that non-coding DNA? What is it good for? So let's take a closer look. Well, first of all, it turns out that over 50% of the DNA inside you is repetitive nonsense. And the first, and so we're going to talk about different, there's different kinds of repetitive DNA, and the first kind I'm going to talk about is called tandemly repetitive DNA, also called synonymously called satellite DNA. So these are, you know, basically the same thing. And what it is a short sequence that's of DNA that's repeated many times. So, for example, let's take the base sequence GTTAC. And if I repeat that again, GTTAC, and again, GTTAC, GTTAC, on and on and on, that's what I mean by tandemly repetitive DNA, because it's repeated, and it's repeated right next to itself, and again and again and again. So it's all there sort of strung out together. It's also given the name satellite DNA because when they originally did the research and they discovered this stuff, they cut up the DNA with restriction enzymes, and they found that when they centrifuged the all this chopped up DNA, the main DNA would sort of clump in a certain area of the test tube, but this repetitive DNA had a slightly different density, and so it was found near the main band of DNA, but not right in the same area. And that's why it's called satellite DNA, because it's kind of like a satellite, you know, revolving around a planet like ourselves. And so if you think of the main DNA as in this main band, you have these satellite bands, okay? And if you want to know more about what, you know, this is called density centrifugation, you can read about the Meselson and Stahl experiment. And it's kind of a good thing to remember anyway, because you'll probably be tested on that in the AP bio exam. And they use a similar technique. Now, another just interesting sort of factoid about this is that it's used in DNA fingerprinting. So this technique is, they've known about this for a long time. DNA fingerprinting was developed in the 1980s by a guy that lived in England. And, you know, you may think, oh, the way you can tell people from one another is you want to look at their protein coding genes. Well, it turns out that's not actually how they tell people apart. They actually look at this repetitive DNA, and by doing this in a certain way, they look at a lot of different sites on different chromosomes. The likelihood of any, you know, two of us being the same when you pick enough different sites is astronomically high. So they can look at this and they can analyze it and tell the difference. So, you know, in crime scenes, they'll go and take a little bit of blood and they'll look at their tandemly repetitive DNA at a bunch of different sites. And then they'll look at the suspect and they'll look at their sites. And if they don't match up, then clearly it's not the... that person wasn't the murderer or whatever. So that's how it's done. We're not going to go into the details of how that works, but they used tandemly repetitive DNA and they used gel electrophoresis, which you guys read about last night. So that's how it's done. Turns out that somewhere between 10 to 15% of all mammalian DNA is this kind of DNA. And The interesting thing also you'll see over here is that the length of the repeated unit is no more than 10 nucleotides long. I've shown you here an example that's 5 nucleotides long, but it can be as little as 1 and as great as 10. And then they categorize them even further into regular satellite DNA, mini satellite DNA, micro satellite DNA. So you'll read these terms if you're interested in this, and you read in this area, you'll hear all these different terms. But they're all, it's kind of a subcategory of tandemly repetitive DNA. Now, where is this stuff found? Well, it turns out that tandemly repetitive DNA is found at two locations, centromeres, and the word derivation, you remember centro means central, mere means part, and it's the central part of the chromosome. Telomeres, you remember telomeres, telos means end, mere means part, so the end part of the chromosomes. So basically, this is where you'll find the tandemly repetitive DNA, at either end of the chromosomes or in the middle, at what's called the centromere. And it seems to have some kind of structural role for chromosomes, we think. We know that centromeres are important in the separation of sister chromatids and cell division. We know that telomeres are located at the end of chromosomes, and they become shortened every time there's a cell division. And remember that the telomeres, you probably remember this from a previous lecture, have contained thousands of repeats of this nucleotide sequence, TTAGGG, TTAGGG, on and on and on and on. And so we think, there's various theories, but you think one of the reasons you have these tandemly repetitive DNAs found in these areas is you certainly wouldn't want to find functional genes in these areas, because you don't want to put a functional gene near the end of a chromosome, because as the chromosome shortens, you could lose a functional gene. You don't want to put a functional gene near the center of the chromosome, because sister chromatids connect there, and maybe there could be some mess up of the DNA somehow, and that could mess up one of your functional genes. So that's why perhaps the tandemly repetitive DNA is found in these locations. Yeah. Yeah, I told you 10 to 15%, right, of all DNA is tandemly repetitive. Okay. Well, this is kind of interesting. It turns out that tandemly repetitive DNA can cause diseases. And all the diseases of tandemly repetitive DNA affect the nervous system. And the first one is Fragile X syndrome. And in Fragile X syndrome, CGG is repeated hundreds or even thousands of times, creating what's called a fragile site on the X chromosome. And what it ends up resulting in is mental retardation. And you can actually read more about this on page 274 of your book. Another disease is called Huntington's disease. Do you remember where we read about this? Where did we read about Huntington's disease? I had you do a reading on Huntington's disease. Do you remember? Where? Fate. Yeah, Matt Ridley's book, Genome, the chapter on fate. And what do you remember about Huntington's disease? Does anyone remember anything about that? Yeah. Right. It causes uncontrollable muscle movement and ends up in death. Yeah. It's autosomal dominant. Very good. What else? It's irreversible and what?
Incurable.
Exactly. Yeah. And what do you know about the, what causes it? Do you remember what causes it? Yeah. It's inherited. And what specifically is causing it? Right. In fact, it's a CAG repeat. Do you remember that? And it's just repeated multiple times. And, so you basically have these long stretches of a protein that just codes for glutamine. That's it. So it's kind of interesting. And the more repeats you have, the worse it is, and the earlier onset you get it. You generally get this in middle age. So you'll be fine your age. But then at some point, you're going to start getting this disease. And of course, I don't know if it said the famous folk singer. Do you remember the famous folk singer who had this disease? His name was Woody Guthrie. And then the whole, when I was growing up, the big deal was Woody Guthrie got Huntington's disease. And the question was, will his son, who was also a musician, Arlo Guthrie, will Arlo Guthrie, when he gets to be middle age, will he come down with Huntington's disease? And so there was always, I remember in my classes in college, you know, when they lectured about Huntington's disease, this was like the big question, will Arlo Guthrie get Huntington's disease? Because back then they couldn't tell. Turns out he didn't get it. So he didn't inherit the trait. Yeah. No, totally different. Totally different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you check your genome at like 18, can you tell if you're going to get Huntington's?
Yeah, they now have a test. You can know if you're going to get Huntington's disease. There is a test you can get. And so if you know that it's in somewhere in your inheritance, you know that someone like a grandparent or a parent or something got the disease, you know, there's a, like if your parent had Huntington's disease, you have a 50-50 chance of getting it. So some people don't want to know. Some people do want to know. The test is available. Okay, interspersed repetitive DNA. This accounts for, this is where most of your repetitive DNA is. It's anywhere from 25 to 40% of all mammalian DNA is made of interspersed repetitive. And remember, the tandemly repetitive only accounts for 10 to 15%. And it turns out that it tells you what it is. Interspersed means that they're not found next to each other like the tandemly repetitive. So there's sort of these repetitive elements are just scattered throughout the genome. And what's also different is that instead of being, let's say, anywhere from 1 to 10 nucleotides long, they're much longer. They can be hundreds to thousands of base pairs long. And then it's repeated in different places all over the genome. And the copies are similar, but they're not necessarily identical. So you can tell that they're related, but there may be a few changes in bases here and there. The most famous example of interspersed repetitive DNA are called ALU elements, and they're about 300 base pairs long, and they can be transcribed, but the function, if any, is not known. And this number is kind of staggering. I want you to check this out. 5% of the human genome is made of ALU elements. Now, let's just do a check. How much of the human genome codes for actual proteins? 3% or less. So this little sucker, ALU, is almost twice as common in your genome as, and it doesn't code for anything that we know of. And yet it's almost twice as common as all the genes that code for proteins. And the lab that I'm going to hopefully do next week, and if it's not next week, we'll do it soon, we're going to actually look at ALU elements in you. We're going to look at your ALU elements. And we're going to use PCR and gel electrophoresis. It's going to be a high-tech lab. It'll be cool. Okay. Well, you might have been asking yourself, where do these repetitive elements come from? And it turns out transposons are responsible for them. And if we look at transposons, there's two broad categories that cause these. One is called class 1 transposons, which are also known as RNA elements, and they move by copy and paste, and they use the enzyme reverse transcriptase. And then there's class 2 transposons, which are known as DNA elements, and they may, many of them move by cut and paste or copy and paste. So let's take a look at them in a little more detail, and they use transposase as the enzyme. So if we look at class 1 transposons first, these are known as retrotransposons or retroposons, and they use reverse transcriptase. So if we look at our illustration here, which I believe is from your book, this is this chunk of DNA, okay? And there's the retrotransposon in dark blue. Obviously, it goes through transcription. You make messenger RNA. But this piece of messenger RNA translates the protein reverse transcriptase, which is an enzyme. That reverse transcriptase then comes back and basically makes a DNA copy of that messenger RNA. And so now you've got a blue, they've colored it in blue now, that's the DNA, which is simply a copy of the messenger RNA. And then that is inserted somewhere else in the genome. So that's how you start making more of these and, you know, start finding them all over the place. Yeah. Yeah, retro just refers to the fact that when you're going from messenger RNA to DNA. So whenever you see that word retro, that's where you get it. Yeah. Yeah. Right, but remember we have interspersed, or we have tandem and interspersed. If you add the numbers up, it comes up to about 50%. Right? If you add 40% to 10%, you get 50%. Right? So, class 2 transposons are known as DNA elements. The enzyme is transposase. And here, once again, you see DNA. And look at this. There's your transposon. We've already looked at transposons before, but take a look at it. You've got the transposase gene in here. You've got the inverted repeats on either side. The transposase gene makes the enzyme. The enzyme then takes that transposon and loops it out of the DNA and then inserts it somewhere else. And in this particular illustration, it happens to insert it inside of a protein coding gene, which disrupts that gene. So you can actually mess up a good gene by sticking a transposon in the middle of it. And that's happened in the past evolutionarily. Now, the next couple of slides are not here to intimidate you. It's just to, these are what I call transposon appreciation slides. These are taken from a book that was published last year. So this is the latest, greatest on transposons. And so I just wanted to make you aware of it. You do not need to know this for the test, but I want you to just be aware that transposable elements are classified in different ways. Here's the RNA elements, the DNA elements, and then you've got characteristics, and it just goes on and on. But I just want you to be aware, so the, you know, those of you that find this interesting will be aware of all the different kinds of transposable elements that we have inside of our genome. And then once again, this next slide even breaks it down in finer detail, and you've got what are called lines and signs and retrovirus-like elements and DNA transposons, and they show what they look like. They talk about how long they are, the copy number, you know, that you'll see. And then, of course, I find this number the most interesting, the fraction of the genome that's made of these different kinds of transposons. And if you add it up, you come somewhere close to 40 to 50% of the human genome is made up of these things. So it's kind of amazing. So anyhow, just different ways of thinking about transposons. It's very complicated. If you take a course in college, you can learn all about these and the details, but I'm just giving you a really quick overview. One of the things that's interesting is that some of the repetitive DNA sequences are transcribed, but they don't make proteins. And I'm going to talk about what I call multi-gene families, where you get a collection of very similar genes. And we believe that the reason you get this is because they evolved from a single ancestral gene. Right, Scotty? Good. Okay. Does anyone know of a RNA or that is transcribed but not translated? And so is used some RNA that's transcribed but not translated? You've actually learned of some. Yeah. rRNA. What is rRNA? What does it do? It's part of the ribosome. What does the ribosome do? What does the ribosome do? Who knows what the ribosome does? What does it do? It codes for proteins. So the ribosome is where proteins are made. So so we're going to talk about this. Ribosomal RNA. Remember that ribosomes are these large structures. They're made out of a whole bunch of different proteins. And I don't think I told you this before. Four different kinds of ribosomal RNA. And molecular biologists have given them the special names, 18S, 5.8S, 28S, 5S. These are all different links. You don't need to memorize this, but just, okay. Now, it turns out that three of these ribosomal RNAs are found together, right next to each other, on the DNA. And so we call it a gene family. They're transcribed, as you see here, and then they're chopped up, so now you've got your three different ribosomal RNAs, and these can go join with the proteins and the other ribosomal RNA to make ribosomes. And it turns out that if you look at this, what we call gene family, these three ribosomal RNAs that are close together, this whole little cluster is repeated about 300 times on five different chromosomes. Okay, so it's spread all over the genome. Why do you think that's true? Any ideas why that might be true? Why do we have lots of copies of this all over the genome? Yeah. Yeah, so you can make lots of ribosomal RNA. Why is it important to make lots of ribosomal RNA? Yeah, because we need to make ribosomes because ribosomes make proteins. So we need lots of ribosomes. So we need the ribosomal RNA. Okay. One last thing I want to talk about are pseudogenes. And they are DNA that are similar to real genes, but they may lack regulatory sequences. They may lack promoters or something. So they really can't function. But they're pretty much almost identical to real genes. And how they probably are created is we believe that at one time there was a functional gene, that it was transcribed into RNA, it was spliced, reverse transcription occurred, you made a new piece of DNA, but maybe the promoter was removed, maybe something was messed up, and then it's reintegrated into the genome. And we know it's related to the original functional gene, but it's missing some things, so it can't function. So we call it a pseudogene, so it's no longer active. And a great story of this is the hemoglobin story. And you guys all know what hemoglobin does, right? It's the protein that basically carries oxygen in the red blood cells. And it's made of four tertiary subunits that join together into a quaternary protein. And the two subunits are very similar, there's two groups of subunits, and they're categorized as alpha globins or beta globins. And they're slightly different, but very, very similar. And it turns out that we believe there was an ancestral globin gene, that then was duplicated. So now you have two globin genes. Then there was a mutation in one of them, so now they're different. They're not the same anymore. And so one's called alpha, one's called beta. And then there was a transposition event where they were moved to separate chromosomes. One moved to chromosome 16, the other one was on chromosome 11. And then there was further duplication and mutations, so that today what we see is we see on chromosome 16 some functional alpha globins, but there's some ones that look like it, but they don't function anymore, so we call them pseudogenes. They're green on my slide here. The functional ones are red. And then over on chromosome 11, we see the beta globin gene, and you see the red ones are the functional ones, and a green one there is the pseudogene. So you can see, it's really cool, like if Darwin were to be living today and he were to see this, it's a really neat story where we can look at the distribution of chromosomes on chromosome 16 and chromosome 11 today. And because we understand sort of how evolution works and how molecular biology can mutate and duplicate and all this kind of stuff, we can sort of trace back the evolutionary history of how we got the hemoglobin that we have today. It's so cool, from some original ancestral globin gene. It's a really neat story. And that explains why we have these different kinds of alpha and beta globin, and it also explains why we have pseudogenes that look pretty much like them but no longer function. It's a really neat story. So anyhow, you know, the take-home message from this lecture is that our genome is very complicated. There's all this stuff called junk, but we're finding out more and more about it, and in your lifetime, we're going to pretty much decipher what all this junk is and what it means. And we don't quite know yet, but we're starting to get some insights into it. And there's stuff that's even going on today that I'm not telling you about because we just don't have time. Some really cutting-edge stuff that they're really starting to understand. Okay.